A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And it's the kind of question that sounds academic until you've actually lived through the consequences of getting it wrong. He's asking about high context and low context cultures. This idea that in some societies, meaning lives in the words themselves, and in others, it lives in everything around the words. The relationship, the silence, what isn't said. He wants concrete examples of both, and how they actually play out in social and workplace settings.
This isn't just taxonomy for taxonomy's sake. Here's the thing. Imagine you get an email from a manager that says, and I quote, "I've looked over the proposal. Let's discuss when you have a moment." That's it. No emoji, no exclamation point, no great work. Preamble. Now, if you're in Berlin, you probably read that and think, all right, meeting's on the calendar, let's hash it out. If you're in Tokyo, you might spend the next 3 hours trying to decode whether "let's discuss" is a polite way of saying, "this needs a complete rewrite, and I'm deeply concerned about your judgment."
If you're in Sao Paulo, you're probably wondering why this person didn't just walk over to your desk and tell you what they actually think over coffee. Because the email itself feels cold and almost suspiciously formal.
Same 21 words, three completely different interpretations. And the manager who sent it probably has no idea they just confused two-thirds of their team.
Which is the quiet disaster of modern work, isn't it? Remote and hybrid setups have collapsed geography. You've got someone in Osaka, someone in Dusseldorf, someone in Mexico City, all in the same Slack channel, all reading the same message through completely different cultural lenses. And most organizations are still running on one default communication style. Usually, whatever the headquarters culture is.
The cost of that isn't abstract. It shows up as projects that stall because nobody realized that might be difficult actually meant no. It shows up as attrition. People leaving not because the work was bad, but because the feedback style felt like an assault. It shows up as decisions that get made in meetings that weren't really meetings, in conversations that happened before the meeting, and half the team didn't even know there was a pre-meeting. You're already jumping ahead. But yes, the Japanese practice of informal consensus building before the formal meeting. If you don't know Nimawashi exists, you walk into the room thinking you're about to have a real discussion, when in reality the decision was already made 3 days ago over tea, and you're just watching the choreography.
That's the tension Daniel's pointing at. In some cultures, the lubrication is implicit. You're expected to read the air, pick up on what's not being said, preserve face, maintain harmony. In others, the lubrication is explicitness. Say what you mean what you say, and if you're not direct, you're being inefficient or even dishonest.
What makes this genuinely tricky is that neither mode is wrong. They're both rational adaptations to different social structures. The question is, what happens when they collide?
Which they do every single day now. In every multinational Slack thread, in every cross-border Zoom call, in every email chain, where someone from a low-context culture thinks they're being helpfully clear, and someone from a high-context culture experiences that clarity as aggression or naivete.
Let's unpack this properly. Where does this framework even come from, and what does it actually look like on the ground? The framework comes from Edward T. Hall, an anthropologist who published Beyond Culture in 1976. Hall had spent years studying communication breakdowns between cultures. He worked for the State Department training diplomats in the 1950s, actually, and he noticed something that seems obvious in retrospect, but nobody had really systematized. In some cultures, most of the meaning in communication is carried by the words. In others, most of the meaning is carried by everything surrounding the words.
Where meaning lives, that's the core question.
Hall called the first type low context and the second type high context. High context communication relies on shared background, nonverbal cues, hierarchy, what's unsaid. Low context communication puts the burden on the explicit verbal message. Say it, spell it out, leave nothing to inference.
Hall's insight was that this isn't just about politeness or personality. It's structural. If you live in a society where you've known the same people your whole life, where relationships are dense and durable, you don't need to spell everything out. The context does the work for you.
And if you live in a society where you're constantly interacting with strangers, with people from different backgrounds, where turnover is high and networks are loose, you need explicit clarity to reduce risk. The communication style is an adaptation to the social structure.
The Japanese nemawashi we mentioned. That's high context functioning exactly as designed. Everyone in the room shares enough history and unspoken hierarchy that the real decision-making can happen informally. The meeting is just the formal seal.
The German directness, this is wrong, fix it. That's low context functioning as designed. In a society with strong institutional trust but less reliance on lifelong personal networks, you want the words to carry the full load because you can't assume the other person shares your unspoken frame.
Here's where I think people get sloppy with this framework. It's a spectrum, not a binary. No culture is purely one thing. Japan has low-context situations, legal contracts, technical manuals. The United States has high-context situations. Inside jokes, family dynamics, any group where you had to be there does the explanatory work.
Individuals vary enormously within any culture. A young Tokyo startup founder might communicate far more directly than a 70-year-old farmer in rural Minnesota. The framework describes dominant tendencies, not deterministic rules. Hall himself was careful about this, though a lot of the business book versions of his work stripped out the nuance.
Of course they did. Germans are blunt, Japanese are vague. Sells more consulting gigs than communication style is a probabilistic distribution shaped by institutional and relational density.
That's the most sloth thing you've said all day.
But the point stands, the value of Hall's model isn't in sorting cultures into boxes. It's in giving you a lens for diagnosing what's actually happening when communication breaks down. Is the meaning in the words, or is it in the silence between them?
Let's get concrete. Japan is the classic high-context example, and nemawashi is the perfect entry point. The word literally means digging around the roots. It's the informal consensus building that happens before any formal meeting. You have one-on-one conversations, you float ideas over drinks, you surface objections in private where nobody loses face. By the time the official meeting convenes, everyone already knows the outcome.
Which means if you're an outsider who doesn't know nemawashi exists, you walk into that meeting thinking it's a deliberation. You raise a real objection. And suddenly the room goes quiet. Not because you're wrong, but because you've just violated a script nobody told you was running.
That's the opacity problem. High-context cultures are extraordinarily efficient for insiders. You don't need to explain everything because the shared context is dense, but they're nearly impenetrable for outsiders. Saudi Arabia is another strong example. Business relationships there rely heavily on Waista, the network of personal connections and accumulated trust. A message from someone you've known for 15 years means something completely different from the same message sent by a stranger, even if the words are identical.
The relationship is the decoder ring.
And across much of Latin America, you see the same pattern around indirect refusals. In Mexico or Brazil, saying no directly can feel like a relationship rupture. So you hear things like, let me see what I can do, or we'll look into it, which to a low-context listener sounds like a genuine maybe, but in context means this isn't happening.
I've seen this play out in real time. An American project manager told me about a Mexican partner who kept saying, we'll review the timeline. And the American kept following up with revised timelines, thinking they were negotiating, when the actual message was, the deadline was impossible, but I'm not going to embarrass you by saying so directly.
That's the classic collision. Now flip it. Low-context cultures put the burden on the words themselves. Germany is the canonical example in Hall's original research. Directness is expected even in hierarchical settings. A junior engineer is supposed to tell a senior engineer that specification is wrong. It's not insubordination, it's professional competence.
The German nein actually means no.
In the United States, you see it in the obsession with explicit contracts, with getting to the point, with the cultural suspicion that if someone is being indirect, they're probably hiding something. And in Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, you get this fascinating combination of flat hierarchies and direct upward communication. A Danish employee telling their CEO, I think that strategy is a mistake. Isn't being brave, they're just doing their job as they understand it.
Which brings us to the mechanism underneath all of this. Why does a culture tip toward high or low context? Hall's insight was that it maps to social trust structures. High context cultures tend to have dense, long-term social networks where you're interacting with the same people across decades. The shared history is so thick that you don't need to spell things out. The context carries the load.
Low context cultures tend to be more transient, more diverse in their interactions. The United States is a nation of immigrants and internal migrants. You're constantly dealing with people who don't share your background. So you develop a communication style that assumes no shared context, because assuming shared context is how you get sued.
Or shot, historically speaking. Explicit clarity reduces risk when you can't count on the other person knowing your unspoken rules.
There's also an institutional dimension. Countries with strong formal institutions, clear legal systems, enforceable contracts, regulatory transparency, can afford lower context communication because the system provides the trust. Countries where institutions are weaker or less consistent often develop higher context communication because personal relationships have to do the work that institutions can't.
The communication style isn't a personality trait of the nation. It's a rational adaptation to, can I count on the contract or do I need to count on the person?
This connects directly to something Aaron Meyer mapped out in The Culture Map, what she calls the confrontation continuum. She found that in some cultures, direct disagreement is actually a sign of engagement and respect. Israel and Russia are the textbook cases. If you're in a meeting in Tel Aviv and nobody's arguing with you, that's when you should worry. It means they've checked out. In France, intellectual confrontation is practically a sport. You're expected to challenge ideas vigorously, and it doesn't damage the relationship. But in Thailand or Mexico, that same behavior reads as aggression or public shaming. Meyer tells a story of a German manager who gave blunt, negative feedback to a Thai employee in front of colleagues, and the working relationship was damaged for months. Not because the feedback was wrong, but because the delivery violated every norm the Thai employee had about preserving face.
Here's the twist that makes this hard to navigate. The German manager thought they were being respectful. In their framework, directness is respect. Beating around the bush is what you do when you don't respect someone enough to be honest. The Thai employee experienced the same behavior as profound disrespect. Both people are operating from coherent value systems, and neither one is wrong about their own framework. They're just using different operating systems.
That's the trade-off in a nutshell. High-context communication preserves relationship at the cost of clarity for outsiders. Low-context communication preserves clarity at the cost of emotional warmth. Neither is universally better. They're optimized for different social environments. The problem is when you're in a mixed environment and nobody's acknowledged the mismatch.
You've got high context efficiency that's opaque to newcomers, and low context inclusivity that can feel like being hit with a brick. Pick your poison.
That's where we get to what I think of as context blindness. In management, this thing where leaders impose their own default without realizing it's a default. A German manager rolls out OKRs and written feedback forms to a team in Jakarta, thinking they're providing structure. The team experiences it as surveillance. Why does he need everything written down? Doesn't he trust us?
The form itself reads as an accusation. If you trusted me, you wouldn't need a document.
And the flip side is just as damaging. A high-context manager from, say, Mexico City, expects her team in Stockholm to read between the lines. To understand that we should consider other approaches actually means this direction is wrong. Please propose alternatives. The Swedish team hears ambiguity and assumes she's undecided. 3 weeks later, nothing's changed, and she's frustrated that nobody picked up what she was clearly signaling. The remote work explosion made all of this much worse. When you lose physical context, body language, the informal chat before the meeting starts, the ability to read the room, high-context communication breaks down faster. You can't do nimawashi over Zoom. You can't have the real conversation in the hallway after the meeting when there is no hallway.
Everyone defaults to low-context tools. Slack, email, Jira tickets. The medium itself pushes toward explicitness. But the norms haven't caught up. You've got a team using low-context infrastructure while still operating on high-context assumptions, and the result is constant friction.
There's a case study from a multinational engineering firm that captures this perfectly. It's been written up in several management journals. German project lead, technical team in Bangalore. The German lead would review code and send emails saying, literally, this is wrong. The logic doesn't handle the edge case. Redo it. Direct, specific, factual. In his framework, he was being efficient and respectful. No sugarcoating, no wasted time.
In the team's framework,
engineers were leaving not because the technical feedback was incorrect, it usually was correct, but because the delivery felt like a public dismissal of their competence. The firm eventually brought in a cultural liaison who taught the German lead to reframe using a sandwich structure, positive observation first, then the corrective, then a reaffirmation of confidence. I can see the architecture is well thought out. The edge case handling needs to be reworked in this specific module. I know you'll get this sorted quickly. Same technical content, completely different relational impact.
That's the thing. Some people hear sandwich method and roll their eyes, like it's corporate coddling. But the attrition numbers don't care about your philosophical stance on directness. If your communication style is hemorrhaging talent, you've got a business problem, not a cultural purity test.
The research backs this up hard. Harvard Business Review published a study in 2023 that found multicultural teams with explicit communication charters, where they agreed up front on norms for directness, feedback style, and how to signal disagreement, outperformed teams without charters by 34% on project completion time. 34%. That's not a soft skills nice to have. That's a competitive advantage.
What's in a communication charter, practically?
It's surprisingly simple. The team spends one session mapping preferences. How direct do you want feedback? Do you prefer it in writing or in person? How do you signal disagreement? Directly in the meeting or one-on-one afterward? What does urgent mean to you? It surfaces all the unspoken assumptions before they become friction.
You're explicitly negotiating the level of explicitness, which is a very low-context solution to a high-context problem, and I mean that as a compliment.
And the companies that have been most thoughtful about this don't just apply one format everywhere. Spotify, for instance, adapted its performance review structure by region. In Stockholm, reviews are fairly direct. Numerical ratings, written feedback, straightforward conversation. In Tokyo, the same company uses a more relational format, with heavier emphasis on team contribution narratives and less on individual numerical scoring. They're not compromising their standards. They're adapting the delivery mechanism to the cultural receiver.
Toyota does something similar. Their review processes in Japan emphasize group performance and long-term development arcs, while their North American operations use more individualized metrics. Same company, same values, different communication wrapper.
Which brings us to the core skill here, code switching. The most effective cross-cultural managers adjust their style based on the listener's context, not their own default. And the research is clear that this is learnable. It's not an innate trait you either have or don't. It's a practice, like learning to drive on the other side of the road. Awkward at first, then automatic.
The pitfall is assuming code switching means being inauthentic. It doesn't. It means recognizing that authentic communication isn't one fixed style. It's the ability to make sure your intent actually lands the way you meant it. If your authentic directness is being received as hostility, you're not communicating authentically. You're just failing in a way that feels honest to you.
Let's make this practical. Three things you can actually do. First, before any cross-cultural interaction, ask yourself one question. Am I communicating for clarity or for relationship? The answer should shape everything. Your medium, your tone, how much you spell out.
Because they're different modes with different goals. If you're communicating for clarity, you want explicitness. Write it down, number the points, confirm receipt. If you're communicating for relationship, over-explaining can actually backfire. It signals distance. Why is he writing me a 3-paragraph email when we've known each other for 8 years?
The medium itself carries meaning. A WhatsApp voice note versus a formal email versus a quick call. Each one says something about the relationship before you even get to the words.
Create a team communication preference map. One page, each person answers 3 things. How do you like to receive feedback? How fast do you make decisions? And how do you signal disagreement? It takes 30 minutes, and it surfaces assumptions before they become friction.
The beauty of this is that it's not about labeling people by nationality. It's about individual preferences. Your Indian colleague might prefer direct written feedback. Your German colleague might actually hate it. The map lets people declare their own settings instead of having settings imposed on them.
Third one, and this is the one you can use tomorrow. Next time you get feedback that feels off, that lands wrong, that stings in a way the content doesn't quite explain, pause and ask, is this a style mismatch or a content problem? Because if it's a style mismatch, the issue isn't what they said, it's the cultural wrapper it arrived in. Reframing it that way. This is a context preference difference, not a personal attack. Takes the temperature down enough to actually hear the message.
That reframe works in both directions. When you catch yourself thinking, why is this person being so vague, or why are they being so aggressive, the answer is usually not about you. It's about where they think meaning lives. Those are the moves you can make today. But there's a bigger question brewing, one that involves the tools we're all starting to use. AI-mediated communication is about to run straight into this framework, and I'm not sure we've thought through what happens.
What do you mean?
Think about what translation tools and auto-summaries actually do. They strip context. An AI summary of a meeting doesn't capture the pregnant pause, the tone shift, the thing that was almost said but wasn't. A translation tool renders that might be difficult, as that might be difficult. It doesn't add the cultural footnote that in this particular conversation, from this particular speaker, those words mean absolutely not.
The tools push everything toward low context by default. They can only process what's explicit, so they make everything explicit, and everything that can't be made explicit just evaporates.
The early evidence bears this out. Companies that have adopted AI meeting assistants report that high-context team members, particularly from East Asian and Middle Eastern offices, feel their communication is being flattened. The summary says everyone agreed when what actually happened was a carefully negotiated consensus that required reading the room. The tool captured the words and missed the meaning.
Which means we're not just adding technology. We're quietly imposing a communication ideology. The idea that if it can't be transcribed, summarized, and action-itemed, it didn't happen.
What gets lost is exactly what high-context cultures have spent centuries optimizing for. The ability to preserve relationship while navigating disagreement, to signal dissent without triggering confrontation, to build trust through what's understood rather than what's stated.
The question isn't whether AI will change cross-cultural communication. It's whether we'll notice what we're losing before it's gone.
The one countercurrent I find interesting is the next generation of managers. People who grew up on global social media, who've been code-switching between Discord servers and family WhatsApp groups since they were 12. They're developing hybrid styles, direct enough for digital tools, but with an intuitive grasp of context that their parents' generation had to learn painfully or never learned at all.
The framework itself might need updating. Hall was writing about cultures that were mostly geographically bounded. A 25-year-old manager in Nairobi, who spends half their day in global Slack channels and half in dense local community networks. Where do they land on the spectrum? Probably in different places at different times. And they might not even experience it as switching.
Which suggests the real skill of the next decade isn't just understanding high context versus low context. It's being fluent enough to move between them without thinking about it, and wise enough to know what each mode is for.
Wise enough to know when the tool is doing the mode, switching for you, badly.
That's the open question I keep coming back to. Are we heading toward a world where AI makes cross-cultural communication smoother by sanding down the differences, or one where it amplifies the gaps by pretending they don't exist? I suspect the answer depends on whether we build these tools with cultural awareness or just with engineering assumptions.
Which is a very low-context way of saying, the people writing the code should probably read some Hall.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, a French surveyor in what is now Niger recorded a local unit of distance called the Song of a Woman Grinding Millet. Approximately 4.5 minutes of sustained grinding, which a British expedition later calculated to be just over 700 meters. The conversion was published in an 1893 issue of the Journal of the Royal Geographical Society, then promptly forgotten until a mathematician rediscovered it in 2023 while researching pre-metric measurement systems.
Somewhere in Niger, distance was once measured in breakfast preparation.
Honestly, that's more intuitive than the imperial system.
This has been my weird prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.